Hi everyone, my name is Chris DC, and what a pleasure this week to catch up with Cassio Masuda. Cassio is an architect. She has been working in the UK for the last 20 years and practices the Japanese martial art of kendo. She's been teaching that for over two decades. Cassio talks about its British development back in 1885 and about the British Kendo Association, which started back in 1964. Now, Cassio, who is the same age as me, has been working in the UK since 1993. Before that, she lived in her native Japan. She came to the UK initially to study fine art, and we learn how she switched to the study of architecture. Now, she has three sisters. Her father used to be a solicitor back in Japan. Her mother still lives in Japan. And we learn about her memories of growing up, playing touch ball, going on adventures. These were the days before computer games. And she went to kendo twice a week with her sister and ended up sticking with it. Cassio talks about how lockdown impacted her. She learned just how important it was to exercise. She talks about kendo being a safe sport, relatively speaking, and how she managed to teach it online during lockdown, finding some funny ways to be inventive. Growing up, she discusses MTV and seeing Michael Jackson and Cyndi Lauper in concert, also practicing the piano and her love of Italian culture. And we also talk about the film The Karate Kid. We turn to Cassio's architecture work, which involves the design of buildings. She's interested in the challenge in seeing what lies behind buildings, and she talks about Port Merion, where people's memories were distorted via space. Cassio talks about how architecture has changed since it became possible to build 3D models using computers, and she speaks about how she thinks theory and practice need to merge. We find out about her earliest memories and how memories play an important role in architecture and dreams. And at the very end of the interview, Cassio talks about learning to make the future better via revisiting the past. It was a joy for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to catch up with Cassio Masuda. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is a great pleasure to have Cassio Masuda for my latest nostalgia interview. And of course, we have a mutual friend, don't we, Cassio, in the form of Danny Chalette.
Hello, Danny.
No, Danny will be listening. In fact, she was really excited because it was thanks to her that we're doing this. And she did say to me the other day, she said, when are you going to do the interview? Do you want to say a little bit about what you do and what your profession is?
I'm mainly an architect. I studied in the UK. Trained in the UK, and I've been working as an architect for over 20 years. So that's what I do for a living. I also practice a martial art called kendo. It's Japanese fencing. And I've been doing it so many years that I now have been teaching as well, teaching adults and children for about 27 years or something. And so my everyday will be this architecture and martial arts.
That's brilliant because I've noticed in the last few years just how big kendo is in the UK. I've got family
who
do it and certainly variations on it. And I know Danny has been doing it for years. So is that quite big in the UK? And is it only in recent years that it's sort of become quite a phenomenon?
It has a long history, actually, in Europe. UK was the oldest country to start kendo. That's going back to my partner is a historian, so it's handy to kind of get information off him. But the first time kendo armor was found was in 1880s, and there was a Japanese village in Knightsbridge, London, built by this very, very enigmatic person called Tanaka Buhikrosen. Supposed to be Dutch, but he wasn't. And he built this Japanese village in Knightsbridge in 1885. He was an entrepreneur, very, very mysterious person. So my partner wrote a book about it. I was part of a research team And so that's how all that is. But when kendo really started, it was in 1950s when this judo person came to teach kendo to one of the judo family's oldest son. So that was in 50s. And then it really started from there. The British Kendo Association started in 1964. So, yeah, UK is what the oldest group of people who started kendo in a format of a group organization. But today, I understand that the population is just about 800 in UK. France had a greater kind of growth in terms of the population. They have about 10 times larger than us one time in the history. So it was a kind of shift in there, but so I wouldn't say it's a big thing in the UK, but it's more popular than before, I'm sure. When I came to the UK, which was in 1993, kendo was much smaller then in this country. I came here to study, so I was a foreigner here, joining these kendo clubs in London, and so my kind of network was mainly kendo at the time.
Yeah, and how did the journey start for you? You say you came to the country, to the UK in 1993. So do you want to say a little bit about your background, in terms of where you were born?
I was born in Japan, Kanagawa, which is next to Tokyo. And I spent the first 20 years in Japan. I came to study in the UK. I was originally studying art and fine art. And I went to a foundation course in London. I never forget the Headley College of Art in Fulham. Rossetti went to that school, and lots of drawings, paintings, all sorts of things. But during that course, one of my friends she didn't become an architect, but she started to study architecture. I can't remember why. She was from Germany and we were good friends. And she was really the influencer, really, to me, to change my mind to architecture, because, fine arts was a bit, I wasn't sure what I was going to do afterwards and what kind of job. Am I going to get a job? And architecture sounded like a science and art mixture, so it sounded really good to me. So at that moment, I changed my mind to study architecture, and architecture is a long course, 7 years, including some odd at the end, that you need some experience, working experience, and then come back to do the diploma. So that kind of stuck me there in this country to study and complete the studies. That's what happened. I changed my schools to do the foundation in architecture, and then started the, I think at the time, Bachelor in Science, diploma, work experience, do the last part of the qualification bit, all in this country.
And is this something that you are surprised looking back that you ended up doing, in the sense that could you ever have imagined when you came over to the UK in 1993 that you'd be doing now?
Just life. Just I was carried by the situations and friends, all the things that I was interested and not interested, and changed my mind. But then once I started architecture, I was already 20 something. So I got stuck with that. I saw that I have to carry on doing that until the end. So at the end of the studies and qualifications, there were some odd things that I have to clear, things like the visa. I didn't have the permanent visa then, so I was going back to home office and renew it. Then they asked me, so now you study and work, how many hours per week do you work? And I had to do so many hours for my qualification, but under the regulations, I couldn't. So kind of learning and being streetwise and clear all these things that I had to do. And at the end of the day, it was in 2000. I finished my diploma. So I was looking for a job, and luckily at the time the economy was good. I got a job, so decided to stay. Never thought going back there ever again. So it's been like that.
I've got so many students, or have students over the years from different countries who, whenever they arrive, that they seem to spend more time going to get their visa sorted at the different embassies.
They sympathise them.
Than they do sometimes on the very reason they've come over here. But it sounds like it's worked out for you. But do you have many connections with Japan? Do you still have family in Japan?
I have three sisters. I'm the second, the oldest, and all my other sisters are in Japan, and all of them came over.
Yeah.
My mother came over, my father came over, and none of them wanted to live here. I think there was a suggestion by my father that one of my sisters was coming here to live with me to study or something, but then never happened.
Yeah.
Later I found out, and I thought, that's a shame. It would have been fun, but never happened.
And what is it that your parents did?
My father was a lawyer, solicitor, criminal solicitor. But he was, when I was young, like 10, he decided to live in his office. So my parents got separated. And so we didn't really spend much time together. My mother she had to look after four children, so she was a busy mother, but she had part-time jobs, lots of things. I would say I was really close to my mother. She's still in Japan and she's now living alone, but one of my sisters lived close to her, so she's looking after her most of the time. And I speak to her on the phone every week, long time.
Yeah. And what about memories of growing up in Japan? Because actually, you're the first person, I was just thinking, because I've done about 120 or so of these, and you're the first person, I think, who's certainly been born in Japan anyway, interviewed. It's a country I'd so love to visit, and I've got so, because I work in religion, and I've got so many big connections to our Asian Studies department as well, in terms of students going over there for a year in order to study.
I think it's quite different from what they do now, but when I was growing up there, so I grew up and then I lived there until I was 20. It was really like the time of really good time for children, because we had lots of time playing outside. And so my memories, like doing dodgeballs, I was somehow a captain of a local dodgeball club. And there were like community groups of people, and because I was born in 1973, which was like the second baby boom, so there were lots of kids to play with. And so local community had adults to look after groups each to form sports clubs. And we had a dodgeball for some reason, and we had competitions, and travel to other localities to play with other local children. And for that, we would team up and then, you know, practice hard kind of thing. So a lot of kind of thing like that was happening. And we played lots of sports. And I think I now realize that either in the UK or I was talking to someone from Australia, she was saying, because we do lots of gymnastics in Japan, so running or gymnastics on mat or jumping on the bath, we did lots of things. So I think we played lots of sports inside and outside the school. And also after school, we would play until we were hungry. So when it was coming dark or someone get injured, it's time to go home. But otherwise we want to play. And that was my memory, was like lots of friends outside playing sports, getting sweat, tired, hungry. It's time to go home. That kind of really healthy.
Yeah.
We didn't have lots of, you know, computer games at the time.
Yep.
So I think from time to time we've gone on adventure, like in a little woods or lakeside or something. Yeah. Not adults, but we were free to go anywhere. We were on a bike. We were running. We were just, you know, hanging around.
Yeah.
And then sometimes get injured. Doesn't matter. And I get crying. And, you know, all that sort of thing was very natural and normal thing happening in the children's society, if you like. And yeah, that's kind of what I did. And also because I practiced kendo during that time. So I started when I was 6. And so twice a week, I would go to kendo class with my elder sister. She would be waiting at home. And I really didn't want to go to kendo most of the time. So I would just take the longest way to go home from school. And then thinking that my sister would say, Kazuyo, it's too late today. You can't go now. Let's skip the kendo class. It never happened. She would be waiting for me at the house entrance door. You are so late. What were you doing? Then I'd be like, oh, I was too early. I should have gone lot later. And then, yeah, we get the gear together and on the bikes when I go to the kendo class. But after the kendo class, I was always happy, like small accomplishment, some sweat, and we need to shout a lot. So as a kid, I think it was good for me because I was a really shy girl. And yeah, the kendo wasn't easy. It wasn't like a game. So lots of disciplines and lots of sitting in uncomfortable position, lots of corrections made, and teachers hitting my head. It's really painful. But yeah, my sister left kendo shortly after because I think she was hit by a boy who was swinging the stick like this, and she was next to him, and she got hit here. She cried, and then she just left.
Yeah.
So my younger sister started, and she was really good at that, and she was winning in competitions and things. I was never very good, but shortly after, a few years later, she quit as well.
It's so interesting, isn't it, that you had sisters who were involved.
Yeah.
And it was because of your sister that you entered, that you became interested in kendo. But then you this is the interesting bit. You outlasted her. Like, it was because of her that you did. But then you took off and you know, you went a lot further than she ever did.
Yeah, I think both of them were really a lot better than me. And maybe that's why they left. I don't know. Yeah. It was difficult for me, so I stayed.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I was also born in 1973, but I kind of regret that I didn't do anything more sporty when I was younger, and I didn't, and it's something that I'm very conscious of, because sport is always something that is very healthy, and many of my friends and colleagues and family members do it, and it's just interesting because I think you get to a certain age, and certainly now in my late 40s, where I start to I suddenly realize, especially when, ironically, before lockdown, I actually put weight on rather than, you know, a lot of people put weight on during lockdown. I lost it.
Yeah.
Then I thought, no, I have to keep healthy. And I was thinking, in your case, do you think that one of the most important motivations is physical health, mental health, just ensuring that you are at an optimum condition? Because that's something which is so obvious and painfully obvious, really, but just something that over the years I've tended to neglect.
Mm. I have to tell you that when lockdown started, and for about a month, I did nothing. I was furloughed at the time, and so staying at home, and obviously, like what you did, everybody else did at that time in the UK, stayed at home, not going out. So I followed that instruction, and a month later, I had to do something. I think this is when Boris Johnson said that you can go out for a run or on a bike once a day. So I did that once a day. I went for a jog. Oh my gosh. I felt freedom, and I felt the air and the space was really, really amazingly reacting to my body, and body was reacting to the space, and I was nearly crying on my own, running by the canal side, and I felt really, really happy that I could run. And that sort of thing. I never realized how important just the simple action of running was.
Yeah.
Exercise, yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought that, everybody needs that.
Because I always think of kendo as being indoors, which I guess it is really. I suppose it can be done outdoors, but I suppose it's something that you do. I mean, does it normally happen in small groups? It always strikes me as something that you would do with sort of half a dozen other people. I don't know what the logistics are.
Kendo is an interesting thing that you can almost do. If you have a good floor, we need a strong floor because we stand with barefoot, so you need a good floor. But then if you have small space, like 6 by 6 meters square space with 4 meters tall space, and you can practice kendo. If you have one another person, so you can be a pairing exercise can be done. And I've done so many times at my club that nobody else turned up, but only one student turned up. And so we practiced together 2 hours, that kind of thing. But when I was a kid, so going back to my teenage time, so gone past the elementary school time, I was in junior high school student. My senior at the time, she was really, really strong kendo person, and she took me to this local club where I meet this great teacher. He's still my great teacher today. But in there, I think there were about 150 kids, and at the really, really peak time, and twice a week we had a practice, and so really squashed in a small space of like 8 by 8 meter space, and small children will be really like back to back, side by side, and so we were really like practicing that kind of congested areas, but none of us would get injured because it's quite safe to practice, and everybody wears armor, like the fencing armor, the same thing, and the floor was soft, it was sprung floor, and everybody took care of each other. So health and safety wise, it's relatively a safe sport. And you'll be surprised, martial arts, maybe you'll be imagining judo or karate, they're probably more dangerous in terms of injuries, but kendo, we don't see so much of major injuries happening anywhere.
And actually, it's worth saying something because you touched on lockdown there. And did you find, is it something that you were able to, or out of necessity, if nothing else, to do online, to teach it online? Because
we started there for, when did we start? I think so. We started in April. So when I felt this greatness of doing some exercise outside, and I thought, well, we should restart. And funny enough that I was on an online yoga class one day on Zoom. Oh my God, I struggled to connect. Yeah. I struggled to see the person doing the yoga. I was struggling to hear what she was saying. Because in yoga, you look down and then stretch and this way, that way. So I thought, hang on a minute, because my partner is the club main instructor. And if he talks, if I do the exercises, we can do it better. And so that's how we started the online sessions. And we're going on for a year and 4 months now. And it's been really great. The people turn up. And at the time was the only opportunity to practice kendo. You know, we cannot correct people, but we can do the exercises together.
Yeah.
And I found some funny ways of being inventive and do this exercise. And then kind of develop furthermore. And then we still do that, everyone, once a week, along with the physical training, because we attracted more people in a distance, like people in Cheltenham, people in, like Dani lives in Kent, so she joined, and she joins practice only online because she cannot come and join us in Watford. And people from Germany and so on and so forth. And so we thought we'd keep this group alongside for some time. So yeah, we did that. But then it's not really kendo. It's kendo exercise together. So it's good to have like a group exercise together online, but then really it cannot be any better than having a real session on the proper floor.
Yeah. No, that was my sense as well, because my daughters, they're very young, yeah. and they do ballet, but they did ballet online for a year. And wow. and it was a bit surreal because it kind of worked, but and they'd be doing it from the bedroom at home, and they'd be dressed in their, the ballerina costume, but they were looking on the screen at all the other people in their living rooms and bedrooms doing the same thing. And it oddly worked. But at the same time, in terms of coordination, it's like when you see people singing on screen and you've got like a choir, virtual choir. It can never be the same thing because everybody's going to be a bit out of step. But in a strange way, it meant that it was just a different side, a different facet, a different way into doing to something.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether, and the same goes for teaching, because I've been teaching online over the last year
I
and
see.
A half.
Yeah.
You just think whether there's something, some advantages or benefits from there that you can take with you into the return to normality, whatever form that will take in the future. Do you have that sense with kendo as well? You rethink the way that you teach kendo, having taught it online during lockdown?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of things to think about and, from different dimensions, of course, But I'm not sure if you want to go back there, I'm not sure. Because if we are going back to normality, we'd like to get on with the normality. It's just that as a back of the mind, this is an alternative if things go wrong or, as this pandemic thing's still going on. So it could be a chance that we have another lockdown. Hope not, touch wood. But there could be an
And just sticking with Japan before we sort of talk a bit more about your time in the UK, but in terms of other influences, whether music or film, is there anything from growing up that you particularly remember? And perhaps importantly, anything that you sort of like took with you, maybe physically took with you in terms of records? Because I think we're the same generation. We remember record players, my own children sort of look blankly and sort of think, what are these strange contraptions? With everything at these days is at the click of a button. But is there anything from growing up that you particularly, as it were, brought with you to the UK musically or filmically, etc.?
Oh my God, my time would be like MTV.
Yeah.
A lot of that was MTV, so I did like American, UK. I think REM was like at the really, really, really popular, and they were there all the time on the charts and. Yeah, like I really like Cyndi Lauper for some reason. Michael Jackson, my friend was a big fan, and her father was working for a radio company. And so she would get a concert ticket for me. And so we went to, I think, two of the Michael Jackson's concerts, and we went to Cyndi Lauper's concerts for some, I don't know how we managed the money side, but somehow we managed it.
Yeah.
And that was really, really exciting for me, like Enya or Brass or, Boys on the Rock and that kind of generation I've come from, Paul Abdul. And also I was into dance for some times. And pop music. But on the other hand, I was practicing piano. So my piano teacher would be really like, strict about how I was getting bruises from kendo. Oh, you should be, take care of your fingers more and don't get injured. And so I liked also classic music too. So coming from two kind of musical tastes, I think.
Yeah.
But I stuck with classical music and opera. Later coming to UK, and that's coming from my father's hobby. He liked opera, especially Italian opera, so he was studying Italian language himself, like by himself, and that led me to study Italian myself. Very, very little, but I studied, and love towards Italian culture is also part of me.
That's a wonderful mix of interest, and a lot of that resonates with me as well. And I think we grew up, albeit in different parts of the world, with the same sort of musical heritage. And I also remember, I was thinking, I mean, one thing that was a bit, it was actually exactly a year ago, may even be a year ago to the day, at the time when the cinemas reopened for a very short period before the next lockdown. And they were showing lots of classic films. I'm just thinking of Kent. And they showed The Karate Kid. Now, this is interesting because it was, now you see, I didn't see it. See, I didn't see it when it came out, but I remember being 11. I even looked up to see when it was released, and it was released in the UK, would have been the week that I started secondary school, so September 1980.
Was it?
And it suddenly took me back to all those friends from school who, now I catch up on them and I go to the cinema all the time. But I remember them talking about The Karate Kid and the influence it had. I know that there's a spin-off TV program that's running at the moment. But it's just so interesting the way in which sometimes we all come sometimes to particular interests, not necessarily at the same time, but the time that's right for us. And I'm guessing that the music that you just mentioned from R.E.M. and Paula Abdul and Cyndi Lauper, I'm guessing that you still listen to some of that music today.
Oh, yeah. And I recognize them.
Yeah.
That Karate Kid, I didn't go to cinema, but I saw the film on TV.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I was a big fan. So I don't know how many times I watched, especially the second one.
Yeah.
And they showed it in the UK, Channel 4 or something sometimes as well. So I watched it so many times. Yeah. And when Danny told us Cobra Kai was on, we didn't know about it, so we rushed into Netflix and I watched them all in the series.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that was fantastic, Cobra Kai. I recommend everyone to watch Cobra Kai, especially the ones who knows Karate Kid.
But because it's the same, it's actually the same actors in some
ways, exactly,
isn't it? Same, like 35, 40 years on, when obviously they're now in their 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. So you came to the UK in 1993, and I'm fascinated in this because obviously when we started, you mentioned that your background is an architect, but do you still do? And do you still practice? I don't know if practice is the right word, but is architecture still something that is an important part of who you are and what you do?
Yes, it is. And I still do practice, and small amount at the moment, because I started when I was made redundant back in October. Yeah, you know, following the furlough period, everybody thought that was redundancy. So I went through that and I started a small business myself. And it's very, very slow and not much happening at the moment. But yes, it is. And I do like designing and thinking about spaces. And now that I take on smaller extension projects kind of things more than what I used to do for commercial buildings, large shopping centers type of projects and some listed buildings, heritage kind of buildings. I do like old buildings, but the bit that I like is that when you go in there to dig out or, you know, take off the finishes of the buildings inside or outside, you find something else. And that's when the challenge starts. And I love that challenge. So things like this need to be done. But then when you go on site, it doesn't work. So think of something else and try to sort out in a different way, because nothing is 90 degrees or straight. Everything's quirky and everything's, you know, what is against the expectation. So when that happens, I get really fascinated and I like challenges in that way.
And how much of it is theory and how much of it is practice? Because it's the same I feel with some of the stuff I'm doing with nostalgia, because the reason I do, well, one of the many reasons I do the podcast is because I was studying nostalgia and reading what people from different disciplines were saying about it. And of course, you can bring architecture into that in terms of old buildings and heritage. And you think of Downton Abbey and you sort of, you know, all of those Merchant Ivory productions. But at the same time, you talk about people and talk to people and hear their life stories, and then find that sometimes people will take you in directions that you could never have anticipated, or there's often a mismatch between their actual and often what they do. You know, everybody knows you know somebody for a particular reason because of a particular part of what they do, maybe socially or through education or through a job or through family. And there are lots of things that define us, like the piano teacher that you mentioned, who obviously thought that in doing too much kendo, it was damaging your hands. But your kendo teacher may have had a different sort of way of looking at the world than your and what was good for you than your piano teacher. Mm-hmm. But do you find that in the case of your work in architecture, is there a sense in which sometimes in the exhilarating part of it is that you don't always know that, you know, what you think you're looking for and what is the right thing to do or to look out for on paper doesn't match what happens when you're confronted with real three-dimensional buildings?
It's always. And I was writing an article about Port Merion, and you know Port Merion in Wales. The architect built this village as an experiment. So he made corners of the squares at different angles. For example, this corner 72 degrees, this corner 66 degrees. But then when you're in that space, apparently your memories of being in the squares will adjust the perception of that square to 90 degrees corners. So the experience space is not much bigger than the actual space. That sort of thing's happening. So he was playing with the people's memories and just giving a little bit of distortions everywhere on the plan, on the elevations. So playing with that memory and being in the space. Space is a funny thing that I find a lot in kind of my connection to my dreams. Because one of the really amazing dreams that I had in connection to architecture, it was something to know people as a building. It might sound crazy, but in my dream, it made sense. And like, the building has personality inside, outside. And when you go inside, look every details, it's like knowing this person. And that really made sense to me. And yet building sits on one land. It had some characteristic, maybe history behind it. Maybe some people used to be there before. Maybe the water used to run underneath, nature surrounding it is different from in the past and now. All that memories kind of nest and live inside the building. That kind of thing fascinates me as one, you know, fact as dealing with architecture and buildings and space surrounding the buildings. When you're in the project, I mean, when AutoCAD came in, 1999, I was still a uni student. CAD was introduced, computer-aided design. Fantastic, that's like a game. So everybody got me into it and drawing straight line without having to draw using your hand. It was fantastic. And you can build 3D models inside the computer. And that is very different from what I just explained, like building on site, nature, ecology around it, history around it, and people used to live in. It's a completely different stuff. And similarly, I think theory and practice is a two really different things. They need to merge to make it work. They always need to merge. And that's sometimes very, very, very difficult. Now that computer-aided design becomes something else called the BIM, Building Information Modeling, it's called. And I'm kind of, at the end of last year, I was kind of, and everybody was into BIM, and UK took on BIM some 10 years ago. And lots of the companies were starting to develop this side of IT section, that because BIM system meant a lot of investment, people's focus into train, and CAD becoming BIM, like the storage, you know, data handling system, altogether was a big thing. So I felt like dealing with projects on site, talking to the contractor, sorting out issues of this level difference, or concrete doesn't, you know, get scrubbed because there's underneath something else and service is running here. It's all very, very different matters. And back in the office, these things are often don't communicate each other, even by the person or by the system or as a solution. So yeah, merging the two together are very difficult in architecture, I find, even so today, because of this technology coming in to supposedly help us resolving matters. But for me, more advanced technology or new technology sometimes is a burden for us.
Yeah.
We need to spend more time to learn it and to bring it into practice so that we can actually use it. And so there's a shift of time that I think it's kind of, I'm not sure if it's a, you know, good way forward. Is it really like going back to the drawing board? Was it a better idea to produce something quicker?
Because it makes me think, because obviously in the context of nostalgia, you know, this sort of sense here about, you know, looking back to an age before technology became so all-encompassing. It sounds interesting that there's a sense that, and we find it with teaching can be aided through online tools, but it can also sometimes, you know, it's never going to be a surrogate, never be a replacement for it. So in your case, is there a sense in terms of the, maybe even the people who taught you, the teachers from you know, a few decades ago and so on, is there a sense that the discipline itself, the study of architecture, has undergone some seismic changes and that a lot of people are not happy with the change in the currents?
I believe they are. And interestingly, when you sent me the questions, there were lots about memories. And interestingly, and maybe it's not in, it's maybe it has to be, but the first project that I did at the foundation course for architecture was first memory. And we made a video, very short video of about a minute, filming to describe my first memory, which was just moving image of tubes. And I haven't revisited that many, many decades now, but at the time of like about 20 years ago when I did that project, you know, when you try to think of your first memory or earliest memories, you need to try and get into a space where somewhere you don't really visit often. I don't think I've visited that place ever since. I mean, I spoke about it to some people, not 20 years ago, but maybe 10 years ago, because memories are something that we need for architecture, of course, and storing memories, important memories, fraction of this and that. By the way, like, some 15 years ago, I had like so many flashing back memories coming from like when I was 7, 6, something. I know the years because I started going to kendo class when I was 6. And it was around that time, 15 years ago, so many came back and I thought, maybe I'm close to death. You know, flashbacks. People say that happens when you're about to die, but I didn't die. And it was just memories coming back to me. For some reasons. But then those memories were stored in somewhere inside, very, very deep, and it just decided to come out that time. And when you kind of store information, especially music is very difficult for me, but for space, orientations and things, the size and scales of things, you need to put in a particular place so you can remember and put it back when you need them. And I think memories are like that. And often they are connected to dreams and not necessarily something tangible. It stays in your head and it comes out when necessary, a kind of thing. And then some small, really silly details that you remember with them.
Yeah, and they can often happen at unexpected moments. You'll write a piece of music and create that. But also going back to buildings. I mean, for many years, I was not in the right place mentally, I suppose, to go back to the place where I went to university, because I'd been there for so many years. Then I left. And then there were just so many memories of people I often associate places with people, but also you think of the architecture and you think also the memories that are stored in a particular building, and whether going back sometimes can be quite a distorting type, in some cases quite debilitating experience. Yeah. And I think in your case, do you find that buildings from childhood or from any part of your life going back to, there are all these resonances, and sometimes it's actually maybe better to keep things locked in our mind as they were, rather than having that mismatch between what we remember and what we see now. And then that in itself raises all these questions about, what have we done with our lives? What are those people doing now? And actually that can be overwhelming.
Yeah. I think if you can let go of these blocks, you'll be the happiest person. And maybe many things can be resolved by revisiting some uncomfortable experiences. But unfortunately, not everybody could do that. And I think I know where I don't want to go, memories that are attached to them, but some of them I don't want to go, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And I think, as I was brought up in this way, like, be in the nature outside, play with a friend until you're really tired that you need to go home. That kind of regime helped me to really naturally follow what is necessary. So you don't force yourself to go to somewhere you don't want to be. That's okay.
Mm.
And yeah, I think that's kind of approach is coming from my childhood.
Yeah, and actually that segs perfectly into the final set of questions that I was going to ask you, which you alluded to there, about the role of memory and whether your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey your life and career.
Positive memories are, I find happiness in that space. I think I have like 50-50 happiness memories, miserable memory, sad and like uncomfortable. And yeah, so both can be strong parts of memories in a sense that they were like shining through leaves of the tree or something. I was holding my hands with aunts one day, walking down in the park or something. That kind of memory is a positive one. And sleepy, hungry, wet in the rain, and having to walk down the street waiting for the train kind of thing. That's a negative memory.
I suppose the question that I'm interested in is whether even those negative experiences or memories sometimes you can feel nostalgic about. And because I suppose that gets to the question of what nostalgia is, because it can be positive and negative equally, like bittersweet. You've got maybe a sense of loss that, something you once had or thought you had that you don't have now. And it's that paradox of yearning for longing for something that you don't have. So, nostalgia is not all positive, but it's certainly not negative, but there is a negative trait to it. But do you think you can be nostalgic about negative experiences?
So longing to be negative situations, maybe not. I mean, my negative memories are, I think, mostly associated with my parents, for example, my father or my late father, because I can't meet him anymore. Passed away 11 years ago. So all the things that were, the memories are associated with like parents having an argument, and while we were on a holiday or something, that's itself is a negative memory because I was feeling really sad. But as a longing part, the nostalgia is that I could meet my father again. So that's a different element, that longing part and the memory of one particular situation which could give me uncomfortableness or even pain. So that's about person, longing to meet this person, maybe. Or, for example, kendo practice. I trained really hard during the high school days, so long hours, morning practice, afternoon practice, all year round. Hard training, sweat, pain, and really like dehydrating, that kind of experience. But I long that time of practicing together with my old friends. And I never wanted to go back to teenage time for, you know, uncertain time of my life and lots of problems, body changing, hormone changing, etc. But I still keep contact with the friends at the time. And now that we have all the line and WhatsApp, we can all connect it. And regardless of time differences and time space difference. And we do meet up when I go back to Japan. So there's a connection, but there are, of course, certain differences in time now that they have their own families now. And then we can't meet so often. And they have different lives now. We're not teenage friends anymore. So that connection we had that time is not what I have now. We lost that. So that can be a nostalgia that I can long for that connection with the people, friendship, and being together in one space together, doing heart training, and happy together when we achieve something, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And do you often wonder what you might have done if you'd followed a different path? You know, if what would you be doing if you were still living in Japan? Do you sort of wonder about, you know, the dreams you had when you were young and whether you've met them? And, you know, because I mean, we all do it to an extent. You always think, oh, what if I followed that path rather than another one? But are those the sort of questions that you tend to think about?
I kind of start to think about it or question that, but then I have no answer, so I kind of forget about it the next moment. Kind of, yeah, I did think about back in 2000. That was the only time I think I had a chance to go back. If I didn't have the job here, I probably would have gone back to Japan and living a different life. Yeah. But it didn't happen, so no, I don't think about it.
Yeah, no, yeah. And that's why memories and dreams, for good and ill, sometimes and creative works. I mean, whether it's film, literature, whatever it might be, they give us those opportunities sometimes to consider other possible lived lives, or through or vicariously through other people's. And sometimes we think, yeah, that could have been me, or in some cases you might think, I'm glad that's not me. That could have been me, but actually, you know, maybe my life isn't so bad after all, because you know, whether you're in Japan or the UK or wherever you might be, you know, you make of it what you can, and you
I think so. And it's not wrong or right, it's just happened to be that way. So if I didn't take this route, there would have been another better route, and then I would have been happy that route if I took that route. So I don't know what I would have been doing if I didn't take this route.
And I've got one more question for you, Cassio, which is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm not sure. There's a saying in Japanese, which is onko chishin. Onko means visit the past. Chishin is to know the future. So learn from the past, you know the future. So you try to make the future better. And I think that's what I try to do. So always revisit the past, study the history, to decide what you need to do now for the future. So future can be improved version of or better than what happened, the negative in the past. And that, I think, is what everybody tries to do by nature, but sometimes it's difficult. And we forget to visit the past. We can be sometimes emotional about what's happening now and choose the wrong one for the future. But then we can revisit what you did in the past and try to fix that for the future again. So it will be a repeat of that, I think, back and future, and stay and decide what you need to do now kind of approach. That makes sense.
It does, and there are some wonderful insights. I have to say that was a remarkable interview because we covered everything from kendo to architecture to the role of memory and dreams. Kazuo, it's been wonderful to have you as my guest this week.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.